You may not realize it, but every minute of every day, you're enjoying your First Amendment freedoms. You can wear what you want, give out your opinion for free, even if it's unpopular. Listen to your playlist. You can put a sign out on your front lawn that says, "Vote for Bigfoot, someone you can believe in." Pray to the God of your choice, or don't. You have the right to hang with a posse that thinks like you do. Tell the government what you think about its policies. They're the freedoms that let you be you, and they're all brought to you by the First Amendment. Learn more at freedomforum.org.
Professionals spend nearly half the work week on written communication, so focus is important. With Grammarly as your AI writing partner, focus and quickly get through your work with relevant, real-time suggestions. And it works across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can sound more confident and persuasive wherever you write. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast.
Hello again. I am still on a break, but don't worry, I'm not vacationing. I am busy catching up on research and writing and getting ready for season 5. In the meantime, I have a little treat for you. Alexa Morrissey from Stranger in the House has gifted us an episode. She has a story for you that is going to leave you chilled to the bone. Now, I can't remember exactly how I found Alexis's podcast, but she's one of my new faves. You can find Stranger in the House, which is by Boy Wonder Productions, wherever you get your podcasts, where each week she will make you wonder if home is really your safe place. And I am going to be back again in a couple of weeks, I think, with some new episodes. And in the meantime, I really hope that you enjoy Alexis's episode that she was so kind to gift us. And again, I would really encourage you to go check out her podcast, Stranger in the House.
It's a frigidly cold evening in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on January 3rd, 1971. Fort Wayne is located in northeast Indiana and is 18 miles west of the Ohio border and 50 miles south of Michigan. It's normally very cold this time of year, but on this day, the city was hit with a freezing ice storm. Most families in the area had settled in for the night and had no intention of going outside anytime soon. And that included the family that lived at 6208 Stony Brook Drive, the Brants. Herbert and Elsie Brant and their 4 children arrived home earlier that day from their family trip to Ormond Beach, Florida. It's about a 19-hour drive from that part of Florida to Fort Wayne, so the family must have been exhausted. The family traveled there every year for a hunting trip, but this year's trip was a little different. According to the Orlando Sentinel, the family had brought their dog with them, and the dog had gotten very sick, so Herbert Brant decided to put the dog out of his misery. He shot and killed the family pet, and the children, specifically 13-year-old Carl and 15-year-old Angela, were devastated. Carl, also known as Charlie, was the only boy in the family. Angela was the oldest, and there were 2 other younger sisters. At around 9 or 10 p.m. that night, the family headed to bed. According to an interview that was featured on 48 Hours, Angela remembers getting into bed to read her book before she went to sleep, something she always did. Both her parents were in the bathroom. Her mother, Elsie, was pregnant with her soon-to-be 4th sibling and was soaking in the tub while her father was shaving. Angela was tucked into bed reading when all of a sudden she heard several loud pops. At first she thought they were fireworks, but then she started to hear her parents yell. She heard her father yell something like, "Charlie, don't," or "Charlie, stop." Then she heard her mom start to scream. According to Angela, the last thing she ever heard her mother say was, "Angela, call the police." At this point, Angela jumps out of her bed and makes her way to the commotion, but she's stopped dead in her tracks because her 13-year-old brother, Charlie, enters her doorway holding a gun. Frozen in fear, Angela watches as her brother aims the gun directly at her and pulls the trigger. except all she hears is a click. For a moment, the siblings just look at each other, realizing that the gun is out of bullets. Then Charlie attacks. He tosses the gun aside, and he and Angela begin to physically fight each other. Charlie starts to strangle his sister, and that's when Angela notices this glazed look in his eyes. And then, just like that, the look is gone, and Charlie lets go of his sister. Seemingly coming out of a trance, Charlie looks at Angela and asks, "What am I doing?" Angela runs outside in her bloody, torn nightgown to find help. Charlie runs after his sister, and the siblings run to a neighbor's house. And when someone answered, Charlie told them, "I just shot my mom and dad." When the police arrived at the scene later that night, they found that Charlie had walked into his parents' bathroom and shot his father once in the back and his pregnant mother several times in the chest and stomach. His father was severely injured, but alive. His mother and his unborn sibling, however, died soon after the attack. The police were stumped by this 13-year-old killer. Charlie confessed that he did it right away, but he said he had no idea why it happened. His father also seemed completely baffled as to why Charlie did this. Up until this point, Charlie had been a quiet, well-behaved kid. There was nothing to suggest that something like this would ever happen. The Indiana courts ordered Charlie to be psychologically evaluated. Three different psychiatrists studied Charlie, and none of them could figure out what was wrong with him. According to one doctor named Ronald Pantsner, there were no signs that Charlie had any mental illnesses. He didn't have any signs of psychosis or distorted thinking. Not a single doctor could figure out what was wrong with Charlie or why he did what he did that night. Police thought that maybe witnessing his father kill the family dog might have triggered him, but the doctors weren't convinced that that would be enough to make him snap and attempt to kill his entire family. Regardless of whatever was really wrong with Charlie, in the state of Indiana at the time, he was deemed too young to be criminally responsible for what he did. He was never brought to trial and was instead sent to a psychiatric hospital for a little over a year. After that, Herbert picked up his son from the hospital and brought him back home to live with his three sisters. Because of Charlie's age, his record was sealed, and if one were to look into his criminal background when he got older, they would find nothing. It was like it never happened. And that's how Herbert Brandt wanted it to be. Shortly after Charlie was released from the hospital, the family left Indiana and moved to Ormond Beach, Florida. During that 19-hour drive, no one spoke of what Charlie did. Not Herbert, not Angela, who had witnessed the whole thing, and not Charlie. The two younger sisters were too young to even know what had happened that night, and the rest of the family had an unspoken vow to never tell them. To them, the worst was over, and they needed to start fresh and move on like nothing happened. But here's the thing. This is just the beginning of Charlie Brandt's story. We will see that despite everyone doing their best to move on and forget that horrible night, the secret of what Charlie did would be uncovered and revealed to be an ominous prologue to a horrific tale. This is the story of Charlie Brandt. Hi, strangers. This is your host, Alexa Morrissey, and today's story is a case I think a lot about. It's a case that makes you question, how well do we really know the people in our lives? Something we explore a lot on Stranger in the House. I think we all like to think the best of our loved ones, even when we can see occasional darkness in them. But I want you to listen very carefully to this story and think about what you would do if you knew someone you loved, a family member or a spouse, was capable of evil. Would you bury it like a dark secret, or would you stay away from them forever and warn anyone who came close to them? Lock your doors and listen closely. This is Stranger in the House. A year after the Brandts moved to Florida, Herbert, the father, remarried and moved back to Indiana with his new wife and the two younger daughters. Charlie and Angela stayed behind and lived with their grandparents, who also were in Ormond Beach. Angela says that neither she nor Charlie ever brought up the night he killed his mother. Once they buried that night deep in their memories, they went on to have normal lives, like nothing ever happened. In 1984, Charlie received a degree in electronics and became a radar specialist for Ford Aerospace in Astor, Florida. 2 years later, he married a woman named Teresa, aka Terry, Helfrich. Before the wedding, Angela allegedly decided that it was time to talk about what happened when they were kids. She thought if Charlie really loved Terry, he would tell her about what he did to his mother before they committed their lives to each other. We have no evidence to say for sure that Charlie did tell Terry, but when Angela and her husband asked if they were going to have kids after they were married, Terry responded, "Considering everything, I don't think it's a good idea." They took that to mean that she knew and accepted his past. Charlie and Terry married in 1986 and settled in Big Pine in the idyllic and tropical Florida Keys. Despite his dark past, according to friends and family, Charlie was a wonderful husband to Terry. Terry's closest friend, Melanie Fetcher, said that Terry and Charlie were inseparable. Quote, "If my husband could love me one-third of the amount that Charlie loved Terry, I'd be the luckiest woman in the whole world," she says. The couple was known to balance each other out and even hold hands whenever they were in public. Terry and Charlie lived happily in Big Pine for about 15 years. That is until 2004, when Hurricane Ivan began barreling its way towards the Florida Keys. The hurricane had already done significant damage to the Caribbean, and Florida issued a full evacuation of the Keys on the morning of September 10th. Charlie and Terry boarded up their home and drove north to Central Florida so that they could stay with Terry's niece and wait out the storm. Terry's niece in Orlando, 37-year-old Michelle Jones, was excited to have her aunt and uncle stay with her that weekend. Michelle was a successful executive at the Golf Channel in Orlando. She lived by herself in a beautiful home, so she had plenty of room for them. Michelle was Terry's sister's daughter, and they were all very close. Charlie and Terry arrived at Michelle's house on Friday, September 10th, and Michelle called her mom, Mary Lou, who lived in North Carolina, about 20 minutes after they arrived, just to update her on their arrival. They were ready to hang out, have dinner and drinks, and Michelle asked her mom if she actually wanted to fly down to Florida this weekend, just to make it a big party. Mary Lou said she couldn't, but she wished them a great time. Mary Lou and Michelle usually talked at least once a day over the phone, but when Mary Lou didn't hear from her daughter over the weekend, she figured she was just busy having fun with her guests. On Monday and Tuesday night, Mary Lou called Michelle to check in and see how the weekend had gone, but she got her daughter's voicemail both times. By Wednesday night, Mary Lou was worried. They talked almost every single day. Michelle not answering and not calling her mom back after she left a voicemail was completely out of character for Michelle. So Mary Lou decided to call one of Michelle's best friends, Debbie Knight, who lived nearby. Debbie stayed on the phone with Mary Lou while she walked over to Michelle's house. As Debbie walked up the driveway, she said she started to have a bad feeling. Debbie had a key to Michelle's house, but when she tried the front door, it wouldn't open. It seemed to be deadbolted from the inside. Debbie made her way around the house to the garage, because while she didn't have access to that, the door to the garage was mostly glass. She looked through the door to see if Michelle's car was still there, but instead, she saw something she would never forget. Inside the garage, Charlie Brandt was hanging from the rafters. Debbie Knight called the authorities, and when police arrived on the night of Wednesday, September 15th, 2004, there was nothing that could prepare them for what they were going to find inside. In the garage, 47-year-old Charlie Brandt had apparently hung himself with one of Michelle's bedsheets. A stepladder lay on the floor nearby. As officers entered the main house, they found Charlie and Terry's bags by the front door, suggesting that they were planning on leaving the next day. There were no signs of struggle anywhere in the house. And from the kitchen, it seemed like Michelle had cooked fish for dinner that night. When they made their way into the living room, that's when they found the second body.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
On the living room couch was Terry Brandt. She was covered in blood and had been stabbed 7 or 8 times with a kitchen knife. When they entered Michelle's bedroom, they faced a completely different type of murder. The room was a bloodbath. Michelle's body lay on her bed with a single stab wound to the chest. She was naked and had gaping wounds on her chest, and her left leg had been removed. Most disturbingly of all, she had been decapitated, and her head was placed on the bed next to her body, positioned in a way so that it looked like Michelle was staring at her own dismembered body. As the police took a closer look, they realized that Michelle's breasts had actually been cut off, and her heart had been removed. Scattered around the room were cut-up bras and pairs of underwear, all from Victoria's Secret, and at the foot of her bed were bloody men's clothing. It was clear to the officers that Charlie Brandt had killed his wife and his niece and then took his own life. Now, motives are not always obvious, but murder-suicides are often open-and-shut cases. We know who the victims are, we know who the murderer is, and we know what the murder weapon was because it's usually laying around. Case closed, right? Well, when two veteran investigators walk into Michelle Jones's house that night, they knew there was nothing simple about this case. There were several deputies that got sick that night after seeing what happened to Michelle. But as veteran Seminole County Sheriff's investigators Rob Hemmert and Bob Janes arrived at the house, they found something even more disturbing. By looking at the way Michelle's body was dismembered, they knew they were dealing with somebody who had done this before. From the crime scene, investigators inferred that because there were no signs of a struggle and the door was locked from the inside, Charlie waited until both women were asleep. He grabbed a knife from the kitchen and then killed his wife on the couch first. They believe that Charlie's main target was always Michelle, and that Terry, his wife, was collateral damage. He stabbed Terry first so that she wouldn't wake up when he mutilated her niece. After he killed Terry, he walked into Michelle's room and killed her with a single stab to the chest. Then, according to the investigators, he took his time removing her body parts. Now, removing body parts from a corpse is not an easy task. But the precision and confidence in which Charlie worked on her body suggested that this wasn't his first or even his second time dismembering someone. Charlie placed Michelle's head strategically on the bed so that she was facing her own mutilated body. And it appeared that he had actually gently wiped her hair away from her face so that she could see it clearly. Charlie then changed out of his bloody clothes and walked to the garage. He climbed onto the stepladder that was found by his body and hung himself with a bedsheet. To the investigators, this wasn't a spur-of-the-moment thing. Charlie Brandt had been thinking about killing his niece for a while, and when he finally got the chance, he took his time savoring her murder. Through interviews with family and friends, Charlie Brandt was never someone that Michelle worried about. He did allegedly have a strange nickname for her, though, Victoria's Secret. According to friends, Charlie would make suggestive comments to Michelle, but she just wrote him off as a quirky, weird uncle. Well, when police heard this, they decided that Charlie had fantasized about killing Michelle for a while based on how meticulously he killed her and the way he placed all the Victoria's Secret underwear around her. Michelle's mother and father, Mary Lou and Bill Jones, were devastated by the news of their daughter's murder. Michelle's mom, Mary Lou, was close with her sister and her daughter, both of whom had been murdered by Charlie, and she was quoted as saying she never thought he would do this. Michelle lived alone in Florida, and Mary Lou and her husband talked to her constantly about safety issues, but they never once thought to tell her to keep an eye out for her own uncle. Most of the people in Charlie's life could not believe that he would do this to his wife and niece. Some even believed that he was set up to look like the murderer. But there was one person who knew exactly what Charlie was capable of, because she had seen it firsthand, Charlie's sister, Angela. Because Charlie was so young when he killed his mother, he wasn't charged with anything, and there was no police record of the incident. No one but Angela, Charlie, and their father were aware that Charlie had killed before. When Michelle's family found out that Charlie had this secret history, they were shocked and appalled that he had been allowed to walk freely for over 30 years, despite the fact that he was a cold-blooded killer. But what police found more disturbing was the fact that they knew there was no way that in 30 years between killing his mother and killing Michelle and Terry, Charlie had not hurt anyone else. Lead investigator Rob Hemmert traveled down to the Florida Keys to investigate who Charlie Brandt really was. A search of his house in Big Pine Key revealed that aside from being a monthly subscriber of Victoria's Secret catalogs, Charlie had an extensive collection of surgery-themed books, posters, and news clippings. His computer history revealed that he regularly searched online for autopsy photos and snuff film websites depicting violence against women. Hemmert knew that Charlie traveled all over the country and sometimes out of the country for work. So he began the enormous task of looking through cold cases anywhere Charlie had lived or traveled. Specifically, he looked for cases where the murder victims were found in a similar state to Michelle Jones. Any case that involved decapitation, mutilation, or a removed heart. So let's go back in time for a second. After Charlie and his family leave Indiana in 1972, they moved to Ormond Beach, Florida. Charlie was about 17 at this point. By 1978, Charlie had graduated from Daytona Beach Community College and then got a job in Daytona. While Charlie was working in this area, on September 20th of 1978, a 12-year-old girl named Carol Lynn Sullivan disappeared from a bus stop in Osteen. Osteen is a very rural area consisting of swamps and forests typical to Florida, and it's about a 45-minute drive from Daytona Beach. 2 weeks after Carol disappeared, her head was found in a paint can 15 minutes north of where she went missing. The rest of her body was never discovered, and her case went cold. 11 years later, Charlie and his new wife, Terry, moved to Big Pine Key in 1989. In July of 1989, the mutilated body of a woman is found under the North Pine Channel Bridge in Big Pine Key. The woman was 38-year-old Sherry Parisho, a drifter who lived on a small boat and was known throughout the area. Sherry's throat had been slashed so deeply that whatever knife was used cut through the bone of her spine. The killer then cut open her chest and removed her heart. Charlie Brandt's house was only 4 blocks, less than 1,000 feet, from where Sherry was found. Charlie also matched a composite sketch of a man who was seen crossing U.S. Route 1 near where Sherry was discovered on the night she was murdered. Even more damning, on the night of Sherry's murder, Terry wrote in her diary that Charlie had come home covered in blood. He told her that it was from him filleting fish. Terry confided in her friend Jim Graves that she was thinking of calling the police because she actually suspected Charlie might have something to do with Sherry's death. Unfortunately, she never made that call. Now, a year before Terry and Charlie moved to Big Pine, another woman had been found there with her heart removed. 20-year-old Laura Saunders was dragged from her car, beaten and stabbed in December of 1988. Because it appeared that animals had gotten to her body before police found her, it's unclear if someone removed her heart or if it was taken by the animals. But it's safe to say that Charlie Brandt was most likely in the area right before he moved. In 1995, Charlie started working as a radar technician. This job required him to travel to Miami now and again. Because Miami was about 3.5 hours away from Big Pine Key, where he lived, he often stayed overnight in a hotel. The day after Thanksgiving in 1995, another mutilated woman was found, this time in Miami. The victim was 35-year-old Darlene Toler, a sex worker and a mother of three. Her body had been found on the side of the road inside a plastic bag. She was decapitated, and like Sherry and Michelle, her heart had been removed. Charlie used the same highway to get to Miami regularly, and he kept a mileage record of his travels, which showed an entry for 100 miles on the day of Darlene's murder. 100 miles is roughly the driving distance between Big Pine Key and the area of Miami where Darlene's body was found. In addition to these cases, police looked at 400 missing women cases in hopes that they would be able to link Charlie to them. Investigators in Germany and Holland even reached out to lead investigator Rob Hemmert after Charlie's crimes were added to the FBI's database. The details of these European cases have not been disclosed, but it is assumed that Charlie's travels may have lined up with similar murders overseas. And that's the scary thing about Charlie Brandt. We don't know how many people he was actually able to kill. His official victims are, of course, his mother, his wife, and his niece Michelle. He was also officially linked to Sherry Parachot's 1989 murder, and in 2006, her case was considered closed. However, investigators believe that there are far more victims, and that it's possible that Charlie Brandt is one of the world's most prolific serial killers you've never heard of. And that's what truly bothers the people who knew and loved Charlie's victims. He had shown his true colors when he was 13 years old. He shot his mother and his father and tried to kill his older sister that night in 1971. But because of his age, he was allowed to walk free and continued to kill for almost 35 years before he took his own life, preventing any sort of justice for the victims. Many people blame Charlie's father and even his sister, Angela, for Charlie's ability to go on with his life after the murder of his mother. They believe Charlie's father should have never taken his son out of the psychiatric unit, or should have at least warned everyone in their lives about how dangerous he was. But in the end, the only person truly responsible for these crimes is Charlie Brandt. If anything, it was up to the state to decide what should happen to Charlie after he killed his mother, and they let him go. So, I want to ask you the same question I asked in the beginning of the story. If you knew someone you loved, a family member or a spouse, was capable of evil, would you bury it like a dark secret? Or would you stay away from them forever and warn anyone who came close to them? And would you ever let them into your home? Stay safe, strangers, and thanks for listening. This episode was written by Alexa Morrissey. Stranger in the House is a Boy Wonder production. All of our sources can be found in the show notes.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.